Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook. First on this week's program, Arizona Republicans now regret abortion ban they refuse to appeal. This story was written by TJ LeHeroux and was posted on April 11th. Republican officials in Arizona are denouncing a court ruling on Tuesday that an 1864 ban on abortion in nearly all cases, including cases of rape or incest, is once again state law. But Republicans' public concern for the ruling from the state Supreme Court is inconsistent with the actions they took to ensure the ruling was possible, wiping out fundamental freedoms for millions of Arizonans. The double talk is unsurprising in an election year when abortion and reproductive rights are at the heart of races and initiatives up and down the ballot, especially in a state where people have long valued freedom from government overreach. Democrats wanted abortion and reproductive freedom to be the central issue of the election. They appear to have gotten their wish, in part through the antics of flip-flopping Republicans. One of the poster children of this two-faced abortion electropolitics is State Representative Matt Gress, a Republican up for re-election in a swing district that straddles Phoenix and Scottsdale. The other two officials from Legislative District 4 are Democrats. After the ruling, Gress issued a statement saying, "Let me be clear, this decision cannot stand," and called for lawmakers to repeal the 1864 law immediately, something Democrats previously introduced to the legislature on January 29th with House Bill 2677. But that wasn't going to happen. House Speaker Ben Thoma, who is running for election to Congress in a competitive race of right-wing candidates, told Axios that he would not permit a vote to repeal the 160-year-old abortion ban. Gress sits on the House Health and Human Services Committee, which never heard a hearing for that bill. On Wednesday, Gress proposed repealing the 1864 law, but leaders of the GOP-controlled Arizona House ended the session. Gress has introduced several bills that attempted to codify fetal personhood into state law, a backdoor tactic that would have limited the rights of pregnant people. In his statement on Tuesday, Gress said the state needs laws to ensure access to contraceptives. "We need laws that respect women and the difficult decision to end a pregnancy in the early stages, before the fetus can feel pain or live outside the womb. And we need to ensure access to contraceptives and IVF," he said. Yet, Gress joined all Republicans on March 13th in blocking an effort by Democrats to vote on a bill guaranteeing access to contraception in Arizona. Kelly Butler, a Democrat and former state lawmaker who was running against Gress in November, tweeted on X Wednesday that Gress used women's lives and health for political theater. "Gress can't fool us. We know his record celebrating overturning Roe v. Wade, sponsoring bills to give a fertilized egg the same legal rights as a woman, failing to protect the right to contraception," Butler added. Gress, who is gay, also has served as a chief apologist for Republicans' extreme anti-LGBTQ plus agenda, voting for bills that attempted to criminalize drag shows and targeted transgender students. More Arizona Republicans backpedal on 2022 law. Gress and State Senator T.J. Shope, a Pinal County Republican who's also in a competitive district, both made statements that a 2022 bill passed by Republicans that bans abortion after 15 weeks was a better and more appropriate law. Shope, however, sponsored an amendment to the 2022 law that clearly expressed that the new law did not supersede Arizona's 1864 law that the state Supreme Court reinstated on Tuesday. Yet, on Tuesday, when the court issued its ruling, Shoup tweeted, "Today's Arizona Supreme Court decision reinstating an Arizona territorial-era ban on all abortions from more than 150 years ago is disappointing, to say the least, and has ignored our legislative intent." Shoup was dragged on social media after his tweet, with people pointing out why his statement was misleading. Of course, Shoup is not the only Republican official who approved the language in the 2022 amendment. The credit belongs to the Republicans, 16 senators and 31 representatives, who narrowly passed it and sent it to then-Governor Doug Ducey. Ducey signed the bill into law, yet the Republican governor also criticized the state Supreme Court decision this week and said it was not the outcome he would have preferred. In 2016, Ducey expanded the court from 5 to 7 justices, and he appointed 5 of the current justices. The only 2 he did not appoint dissented in the 4-2 decision. Justice Bill Montgomery recused himself from the case in November, following reporting from the Arizona Mirror and the 19th, detailing his past inflammatory comments about one of the plaintiffs in the case and his ardent anti-abortion positions. Clint Bolick had no judicial experience when Ducey appointed him. He served on Ducey's transition team and had worked at the Goldwater Institute, a prominent libertarian think tank in Arizona. Bolick and Justice Catherine King are up for retention on the November ballot, which means voters can choose whether or not to keep them on the state's high court for another 6-year term. Yet, voters always retain Supreme Court justices. If Bolick or King are not retained, Governor Katie Hobbs, a Democrat, would appoint their replacement. Bolick is married to State Senator Shauna Bolick, a North Phoenix Republican, who was appointed to represent the competitive Legislative 2 district in July 2023. Shauna Bolick released a statement on X Tuesday, saying that she supported legislation banning abortion after 15 weeks. Considering today's Arizona Supreme Court ruling to uphold Arizona's 1864 territorial abortion ban, it is time for my legislative colleagues to find common ground of common sense. The first step is to repeal the territorial law, she wrote. Yet, Bolick was one of the Republican lawmakers who voted for the 2022 law that did not repeal the 1864 ban. Carry chameleon. State Republican politicians are not the only ones trying to backtrack their way out of a political mess. Candidates for federal office are doing the same thing. Carrie Lake, the likely Republican U.S. Senate candidate with extreme stances on abortion, denounced Tuesday's court ruling. "I speak to more Arizonans than anyone, and it is abundantly clear that the pre-statehood law is out of step with Arizonans," Lake said. Yet, in June 2022, Lake said she was, quote, "thrilled" about the 1864 law. "I'm incredibly thrilled that we are going to have a great law that's already on the books, so it will prohibit abortion in Arizona except to save the life of a mother," Lake said at the time. "And I think we're going to be paving the way and setting course for other states to follow." Lake has frequently changed her message on abortion throughout her years of chameleonic campaigning. U.S. Representative David Schweikert, a Scottsdale Republican who narrowly has maintained hold of his competitive district for years, released a statement Tuesday denouncing the ruling. "I do not support today's ruling from the Arizona Supreme Court. This issue should be decided by Arizonans, not legislated from the bench. I encourage the state legislature to to address this issue immediately, Schweikert wrote on X. Schweikert, however, has supported legislation that defines a child as existing at the moment of fertilization. Schweikert's race could be pivotal for Democrats hoping to flip the District 1 seat in their quest to take back control of the U.S. House. U.S. Representative Juan Ciscomani, a Tucson Republican who barely won election to the 6th District seat in 2022, also released a statement denouncing the ruling. As my record shows, I'm a strong supporter of empowering women to make their own healthcare choices, and I oppose a national abortion ban, Ciscomani tweeted on X. Yet, Ciscomani co-sponsored House of Representatives 7, a bill that aimed to prohibit the use of tax credits to purchase insurance that covers abortion for women who are serving in the military, veterans covered under Medicaid, federal employees, and those covered by the Indian Health Service. A video of September 2022 of Ciscomani walking away from a voter who asked about his stance on abortion began recirculating on Tuesday. The New York Times featured the incident in an October 2022 article titled, "Abortion is Motivating Voters, but Republicans would rather change the subject." In 2022, Republicans wanted to change the subject. In 2024, they will not have that option, especially as a measure that would enshrine abortion rights in Arizona's Constitution is poised to go before voters in November. Here's a story written by Stephen Lemons and posted on April 10th. Rachel Mitchell tries to navigate Arizona abortion ban ruling. Less than a week before the Arizona Supreme Court's stunning 4-2 decision, imposing a Civil War-era ban on nearly all abortions in the state, Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell said she would enforce the law on abortion, quote, whatever that law is. Mitchell's remarks came on April 4th, during one of her regular press conferences. Mitchell, a Republican who is running for re-election, responded to a question concerning what she would say if asked whether she supported a woman's right to choose. She said her role as county attorney was to follow the law. So my answer is, whatever that law is, I will be enforcing the law, she said. Right now, the law allows abortions up to 15 weeks. I know there's a pending legal case to decide if another law controls. That hasn't been decided yet. Mitchell also was asked about a recent announcement from Arizona for Abortion Access that it had gathered 500,000 signatures to place an initiative on the November ballot that would make a right to abortion part of the Arizona Constitution. The organization needs 383,923 valid signatures from state voters and has until July 4th to get them, making it likely the constitutional amendment will qualify for the ballot. Would Mitchell support the proposition? I will have to look at more details of it, but my understanding is that it is very, very broad, she said. As a county attorney, my role is to uphold the law, and I'm going to uphold the law, whatever the people or the legislature and the governor decide it to be. My personal opinion is something completely different. Written for the majority by Justice John R. Lopez IV, the state Supreme Court ruling on Tuesday held that a 2022 Arizona law making abortion legal in the first 15 weeks of pregnancy did not supersede an 1864 territorial statute that makes abortion a crime unless the procedure is necessary to save the woman's life. The offense is punishable by 2 to 5 years in prison. The ruling was made possible in 2022 by the U.S. Supreme Court ruling in Dobbs v. Jackson, which overturned the right to an abortion granted by the High Court in the 1973 landmark decision Roe v. Wade. In its opinion, the state Supreme Court remanded the case to the Arizona Court of Appeals for further arguments on constitutional matters. staying enforcement of the law for 14 calendar days. Mitchell urges lawmakers to come up with, quote, reasonable law. In a statement following Tuesday's decision, Mitchell took a more nuanced position. She said the ruling, quote, rather than settling the issue, has raised issues and caused many to have legitimate and serious concerns. She urged the governor and the legislature to come together to enact a reasonable law that takes these and other issues into account before the 14-day stay expires. It's important for Arizonans to know that in the almost 2 years since the Dobbs decision, my office has not received a single request to prosecute an abortion case, she said. I do not anticipate that today's decision will change that. It is important to remember that under Arizona's law, women who get an abortion cannot be prosecuted. Today's ruling does not change that. Women cannot and will not be prosecuted for receiving an abortion. My priority always has been to protect women, not prosecute them. Likewise, I have made it clear that this office will not prosecute abortions that were the result of rape, incest, or molestation. As a career sex crimes prosecutor, I am keenly aware that the women and girls who get pregnant as victims of these crimes are not hypothetical situations. They are very real names and real faces to me, she added. Notably, the 1864 law does not make exceptions for rape, incest, or molestation. But Mitchell apparently believes she retains the authority to prosecute, or not, abortion cases based on these criteria. In June 2023, Governor Katie Hobbs issued an executive order granting authority over all abortion-related prosecutions in the state to Attorney General Chris Mayes. Both Mayes and Hobbs are Democrats. Mitchell, however, has questioned Hobbs' authority to give Mayes jurisdiction over all future abortion prosecutions. In July 2023, Mitchell and 11 other county attorneys signed a letter to Hobbs, asking the governor to rescind the executive order, calling it an exercise of authority not vested in the governor's office. In a videotaped statement addressing the state Supreme Court ruling, Hobbs decried the decision as callous and seemed to take aim at Mitchell and the other county attorneys who signed the letter. I want to make it clear that my executive order protecting women and doctors from prosecution by extremist county attorneys still stands, she said. For her part, Mays denounced the court's decision in a press release, calling it unconscionable and an affront to freedom. She also vowed that as long as she's attorney general, no woman or doctor will be prosecuted under this draconian law. Mays also criticized the ruling in a press conference on Tuesday with other prominent Democrats. Mitchell faces a July 30th primary against fellow Republican Gina Godby here, who didn't respond on Tuesday to requests for comment from Phoenix New Times. Democrat Tamika Wooten will face either Mitchell or Godby here in the November general election. Wooten said decisions regarding abortion prosecutions are the purview of May's office thanks to Hobbs' executive order. Our AG has stated clearly that she will not prosecute women and or their health care providers for seeking or performing abortions. I stand with AG Mays. If that decision is ever returned back to the county attorney's offices, I will not prosecute a woman for her reproductive health care decisions, Wooten said. Here's another story about Rachel Mitchell, also written by Stephen Lemons, posted on April 9th. Rivals pounce on Rachel Mitchell's plea deal with former prison's boss. Is Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell a rock-ribbed Republican, soft on crime? That's how her Republican primary rival, Gina Godby here, portrayed Mitchell during Godby here's appearance Friday on J.D. Hayworth's radio show on KFNN 1510 AM. The candidate blasted Mitchell for what she called a sweetheart deal with Charles Ryan, former director of the Arizona Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry. God Be Here, who lost a GOP primary challenge to Mitchell in 2022 by nearly 15 points, is Mitchell's only opponent in the Republican primary on July 30th. God Be Here swung hard at Mitchell from the right during her interview with Hayworth, a former U.S. House member from Arizona. She said that a county attorney deal allowing Ryan to plead no contest in February to one count of disorderly conduct for a drunken barricade incident, during which he pointed his pistol at two police officers, was an example of what ailed the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. The problem with the county attorney is that she's wedged between a Democratic governor and a Democratic attorney general, and she has liberal staff that are running the office, God Be Here said. When you allow sweetheart deals, like in the Ryan case, or pointing the gun at police, and you're not holding the offenders accountable, this is the problem we're having, she added later in the interview. God Be Here, the former city prosecutor for Goodyear and a one-time MCAO bureau chief, claimed that the Ryan case was part of a pattern in Mitchell's office. She criticized Mitchell for overusing diversion programs for defendants and sending too many cases to municipalities for prosecution. God Be Here joins a chorus of people faulting the plea deal, including Tamika Wooten, the Democrat who will face the winner of the GOP primary for county attorney. Wooten, a former chief prosecutor for Glendale, essentially agreed with God Be Here on Mitchell's treatment of Ryan. As a prosecutor, justice is supposed to be blind, and Mitchell's not making her decisions that way, Wooten told Phoenix New Times. I think there was definitely some favoritism based on Ryan's former position. Drunk, barricaded, and pointing a gun at police. It's not politicians crying foul. In letters to Maricopa County Superior Court Judge Jeffrey Fish, who is overseeing Ryan's case, the Tempe police detectives who confronted Ryan on the night of January 6, 2022, stated that they believed Ryan had committed aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. That's a Class 3 felony, with a mandatory prison sentence of 5 to 15 years. That's a far more serious offense than disorderly conduct, a Class 6 felony, which has a range of sentencing options, from probation to a maximum of 2 years in prison. Ryan initially was indicted on two Class 6 felonies, disorderly conduct and misconduct with a weapon, with the latter dropped as part of a plea deal. In the letters to the court, Tempe police detectives Michael Casland and Fahad Salama described how they responded to a 911 call from Ryan's wife. She told authorities that her husband had shot and wounded himself after consuming half a bottle of tequila. During a three-hour standoff, Ryan, then 71, barricaded himself inside his home and refused orders to exit. Some 50 police officers responded, and several nearby homes were evacuated. At one point, he opened a side door to his garage and appeared to point a black revolver at police officers, then retreated inside. On body cam footage of the incident, McCasland and Salama can be heard ordering Ryan to drop the gun. Ryan does not respond or comply. Both detectives make it clear that they believe Ryan pointed his gun at them, thereby committing aggravated assault under Arizona law. Mr. Ryan pointed the gun at myself and Detective Salama for 15 seconds, McCaslin wrote, explaining that the detectives did not realize it was a firearm until Ryan lowered his hand. It is not a good feeling, knowing that a gun was pointed in your direction for 15 seconds, McCaslin added. McCaslin said Arizona law allows police officers to use deadly force to protect themselves or others when facing serious injury or death. He said police fired 2 beanbag rounds at Ryan during the confrontation. The Tempe SWAT team also was called to the scene. According to McCaslin, Ryan's wife told police that Ryan had been drinking upward of half a bottle of tequila a night for the past 2 years. She said Ryan would drunkenly patrol their residence at night, paranoid that someone might be breaking into his home. In his letter, Salama wrote that Ryan was lucky to be alive. Salama said that if he had recognized that Ryan had a gun earlier, he would have used lethal force. The detective also believed Ryan was receiving preferential treatment. If a gang member, or generally any other person, had acted the same way Mr. Ryan did on January 6th, 2022, they would be imprisoned with full sentencing, Salama wrote in his letter. Just because Mr. Ryan had never before committed a violent felony as he did that evening, it does not mean he is not capable of doing it again. And it certainly does not mean that he should not be held responsible. Politics are very much involved in this situation. Mitchell's office has given several reasons why it did not pursue aggravated assault charges against Ryan. KJZZ 91.5 FM quoted Mitchell as saying that Ryan never pointed the gun directly at the officers. He's got a gun in his hand, he's moving it around. And so, at some point, it crosses over the officers, she said. The Arizona Republic quoted Mitchell's top flack, Janine LeCure, as saying that the county attorney's office could not prove Ryan's, quote, intent to place officers in harm's way, in part because Ryan was drunk and, quote, unable to form intent. LeCure told New Times that Ryan's inebriation, quote, was one of several factors in the decision not to charge him with aggravated assault. The plea deal was the best result for the case, she said. The short answer is that it was determined to be the best resolution of the case, LeCure said. On February 9th, Fish approved the plea deal, sentencing Ryan to 2 years of supervised parole and ordering him to pay $8,500 in restitution to Tempe police. Another black eye for Mitchell's office. The outcome in the Ryan case rankles many in the valley. Veteran Phoenix defense attorney Richard Gaxiola called the plea deal with Ryan favoritism and another black eye for Mitchell's office. If Charles Ryan were a young Latino or black kid, he'd have been sent to prison, no issues whatsoever, Gaxiola said. It doesn't matter whether the person was intoxicated or on the influence of narcotics. He did that voluntarily. It's not a defense in Arizona law. Longtime progressive anti-prison activist Caroline Isaacs, executive director of the nonprofit advocacy group Just Communities Arizona, said the county attorney's double standard in Ryan's case was glaring. Asked what would have happened if Ryan had been a person of color, she was unequivocal. He would be dead because men of color do not get the benefit of the doubt by any law enforcement agency in this country, she said. Isaacs was formerly program director for the Arizona branch of the American Friends Service Committee, which advocates for the rights of incarcerated people. She was a constant critic of Ryan, whose tenure at ADCRR was plagued by scandal, cruelty, inmate deaths, and controversy. Still, she showed empathy toward a man whose reign over the state's prison system she loathed. I have a lot of anger toward Charles Ryan for what he's done, heading up the prison system in this state, she said. I've seen it harm a lot of people I care about. And if I am who I believe myself to be, I'm going to argue on behalf of Charles Ryan's right to be seen as a human being in this system. For her part, Mitchell, during her regular biweekly press conference on Thursday, defended the plea deal with Ryan. Her response to her critics, however, seem tone deaf. People who are out there opining on this case, without having watched all the body cams and read all of the police reports and listened to the interviews, are just doing that. They're opining, she said. Phoenix expands heat protections for 10,000 outdoor workers. This next story was written by Kathleen Stinson and was posted on April 12th. The Phoenix City Council expanded an ordinance to add more protections for outdoor workers as city contractors. The measure, which impacts about 10,000 people, requires city contractors to maintain a heat safety plan that provides outdoor workers with sanitized, cool drinking water, regular hydration breaks, access to shaded areas or air conditioning in vehicles with closed cabs, and training on heat illness and first aid. The revisions to the ordinance passed 7-0, though council members Jim Waring and Deborah Stark were absent. The expanded ordinance takes effect in May, but the requirement for vehicles to have air conditioning won't start until May 1st, 2025. Employees at Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport applauded the new heat-related measures. Workers for airport contractors complained to state workplace safety watchdogs about heat-related working conditions last summer. With a deadly summer heat around the corner, someone, our employer, the city, or the airlines, whoever's responsible for controlling our workplace environment, needs to do the simple and humane thing and ensure all workers are safe from the heat. Linda Ressler, a cabin cleaner at Sky Harbor with Prospect Air Services, said at the council meeting before the vote. Caitlin Parody, who works with health and safety issues in Phoenix for the National Council of Occupational Safety and Health, also praised the expanded ordinance. This is the first time in Arizona that we've seen rules on the books that establish exactly how employers have to protect workers from dangerous heat, she told Phoenix New Times. The new measures are similar to ones required by the Arizona Division of Occupational Safety and Health, but this ordinance mandates that the heat protections be included in city contracts, which allows city officials to investigate complaints and require compliance by contractors. Filiberto Cordova, a truck driver for LSG Sky Chefs, which prepares and transports meals for Sky Harbor flights, told the council about the impact of working in the severe summer heat. "We spend our days during the summer out there, many times under extreme heat," Cordova said. "I have an ailment in my feet. I start to think about whether I am going to be able to finish this shift, whether my body is going to be able to tolerate these temperatures." The heat at Sky Harbor is dangerous. The expanded protections come as temperatures begin their slow climb to summer's triple digits. In 2023, the heat killed 645 people in Maricopa County, the highest fatality rate ever recorded. In 2023, Arizona recorded 73 days with temperatures above 100 degrees and broke a record when temperatures topped 110 degrees for 31 consecutive days. Cecilia Ortiz, a passenger service agent organizing with the Service Employees International Union, called on city contractors to take the expanded ordinance seriously. "The heat at Sky Harbor Airport is dangerous, and all of us who work there know it," Ortiz said during a press conference before the city council vote. "We are going to hold our employers accountable. They must take this ordinance seriously so we can stay safe at work." Ortiz filed a heat complaint against airport contractor Prospect last summer. Parody said that the city ordinance applies to contractors and subcontractors whose employees are working outdoors, as well as some people in quasi-outdoor areas, such as jet bridges. But the ordinance doesn't cover cabin cleaners due to jurisdictional issues with the Federal Aviation Administration, she added. Cabin cleaners are frontline safety and security personnel who work under brutally hot conditions on planes with AC turned off. They need these protections, I'm optimistic they'll be able to be included in the future, Parody said. Prior to the vote, council members advocated for adding more heat-related protections in the future. Extreme heat is our natural disaster, Councilmember Yasemin Ansari said. This ordinance is an important step. This ordinance should go further. Ansari said some workers fear retaliation from their employer if they take breaks from the heat or feel sick. For all who have voiced support, this is your win, she added. Councilmember Laura Pastor also spoke about a need for an avenue for protecting workers from retaliation. We do not have specific retaliation language in the ordinance itself, Pastor said. It is our expectation that none of our contractors would retaliate against our workers should they complain. Councilmember Keisha Hodge Washington asked if the tarmac is covered by this ordinance. Ground workers would be covered by this ordinance, said Assistant Attorney Lori Bays. It's really the airplanes that are outside our jurisdiction. Here's a story written by TJ Leheru and posted on April 8th. Phoenix Suns owner Matt Ishbia accused of anti-gay slur in voicemail tirade. Matt Ishbia, billionaire owner of the Phoenix Suns and the WNBA's Mercury, is under fire for a leaked voicemail in which he reportedly referred to business rivals as cocksuckers. We fucking took those cocksuckers down. Fuck them. And we're going to keep fucking sticking it to them forever, Ishbia said in the voicemail. Ishbia is the CEO of United Wholesale Mortgage, the largest wholesale mortgage broker in the U.S., according to its website. The voicemail has not been verified by Phoenix New Times. Hunterbrook Media reported that the audio file of the message was leaked earlier this year to a Facebook group with more than 5,000 members called Rocket Pro TPO versus UWM. Hunterbrook claimed it ran the voicemail through generative AI detection software, which appeared to confirm that it was not a deep fake. Hunterbrook Media is affiliated with Hunterbrook Capital, a hedge fund that recently shorted United Wholesale Mortgage's stock. In other words, the hedge fund bet the stock of Ishbia's company would fall. Palmer Black, basketball communications manager for the Suns, did not respond to a request for comment on Monday. Neither did Nicole Roberts, senior public relations strategist at United Wholesale Mortgage. Sid Ziegler Jr., co-founder of OutSports, a media outlet focusing on LGBTQ plus personalities and issues in sports, expressed outrage and disbelief over Ishbia's purported comment. Ziegler also noted he was skeptical about the voicemail. It seems impossible that in 2024 an NBA owner would say this, Ziegler told New Times. I question the voicemail's validity, and if he said this, he is disqualified from being an owner of an NBA team. There is no defense for using that term. Zero. Anybody who uses that term knows what they are saying. When Ishbia bought the pro teams in 2023, he took control of franchises with at least two top executives who were gay. In 2023, OutSports named Ryan Resch, the Suns vice president and assistant general manager, the 15th most powerful LGBTQ plus person in sports. Resch came out in June of 2022. Phoenix Mercury president Vince Kozar is also gay. On Wednesday, the Suns celebrated Pride Night at Footprint Center during their game against the Cleveland Cavaliers. Eric Blome, Vice President of Programs and Corporate Advocacy at LGBTQ plus group Human Rights Campaign, called Ishbia's comments disgraceful. Anti-LGBTQ plus slurs perpetuate stigma and give credence to bias against LGBTQ plus people, especially when it comes from the top of the corporate ladder, Blome said in a written statement to New Times. This type of disgraceful choice in language signals to paying customers and fans, many of whom are LGBTQ+ or allies, that they are unwelcome. Ishbia's predecessor as owner of the Suns and Mercury, Robert Sarver, was fined $10 million and suspended by the NBA in September of 2022 after a league investigation found that Sarver was engaging in workplace misconduct, including the use of racial slurs. We continue now with a story written by Sarah Crocker and posted on April 5th. Criminal charges dropped against chef in dispute with Gilbert Brewery. Criminal charges tied to a dispute between a sandwich shop owner and the brewery he leased kitchen space from have been dropped. Philadelphia Sandwich Company owner Aaron Link faced up to nearly 6 years in prison for two felony burglary charges tied to an eviction notice issued by Flying Basset Brewing, the now shuttered Gilbert Brewery from which Link was subleasing. Link was arrested on October 31st, the day he received an eviction notice, after a Flying Basset owner called police when she spotted Link at the space on a video camera. That was a pretty big leap of faith, but when you're innocent, it's easy to do that, Link says about fighting the criminal charges. The chef relocated to Maine after getting permission from a judge during the criminal case to lead operations at a restaurant group. He says the felony charges made it challenging for him to land work in Arizona. Since the arrest, Link maintained that he was current on his rent and that the arrest was improper. On March 27th, a prosecutor submitted a motion to dismiss the case against Link. Maricopa County Superior Court Judge Michael Kemp agreed and did so on Monday. Defendant provided documentation that he had paid rent for the month in question. That was confirmed by the victim. Deputy County Attorney Misty Foth wrote in the motion, "Therefore, it is in the interest of justice to dismiss this case." Link and the brewery owners, Rob Gagnon and Sarah Cotton, stated that the disagreement stemmed from utility payments, which Link split with the brewery. The brewery closed on September 30th. A civil suit filed by Link in December against the brewery, its owners and property management company, Simplified Properties, and its subsidiary, 720 Ray LLC, is still pending. Link alleged breach of contract, overpaid rent, unreimbursed costs, and that more than $100,000 of his kitchen equipment is being held hostage. The brewery owners and landlord denied the allegations in separate court filings. Link says he's hopeful the dismissal of the criminal charges will support his case in civil court. "You can't just lock somebody out without giving notice," Link says. Writer Paloma Ruhrford of Cronkite News brings us this next story. It was posted on the New Times website on April 12th. How the Phoenix Film Festival works to boost Arizona's film scene. The Phoenix Film Festival is celebrating its 24th year and is dedicated to promoting independent cinema and providing a platform for filmmakers to showcase their work. Jason Carney, executive director of Phoenix Film Foundation and the festival, says this anniversary offers valuable insights into the growth and evolution of filmmaking in the Valley over the past two decades. "Currently, we host approximately 290 screening events during these 11 days, whereas in the early years, it would have been around 40 or 50, Carney says. He adds that over the past 24 years, the event has grown from a modest three-day gathering to an 11-day celebration, attracting upwards of 20,000 attendees. This year's festival began on April 4th and ends on Sunday. Besides showcasing big hits, the festival also emphasizes local and emerging filmmakers. We feature local films, big films, and that includes high school students, college students, and professional filmmakers, all the way up to feature films. It continues to be a big priority, but it's also about wanting to get the best of the best in the festival, Carney says. The Phoenix Film Festival is more than just a way to watch movies. It's also an opportunity to make connections at events like filmmaking workshops and the festival's free industry night. It's a great way for the community of Phoenix and Arizona to come together for a night and network, Carney says. Brett Cornell, an Arizona State University freshman whose short film Memento Mori was accepted into the festival, echoed the importance of these networking opportunities. It's nice to see something that you and your friends put so much time and effort into pay off successfully, Cornell says. For Greg Quadar, director of Sing Sing, which was featured at this year's festival, the event felt like a homecoming. My creative partner Glenn and I shot our movie here last year, and we were very embraced by the community, Quadar says. Sing Sing is set within the walls of a prison and aims to showcase the humanity and potential for transformation through art. That's what the hope of this movie is, that we're going to bring you inside and show you the beauty, the resilience, the restoration that can happen, he adds. Quadar also reveals what the festival means for him. Well, there's quite a lot involved in making films here, but I'm just eager and excited to meet the film community in real time, to present our work, he says. The festival is really the transition where we're giving it now to an audience, and then it doesn't belong to us anymore. So in this space, this really is where we get to actually be in conversation with other artists and with the general public. And my hope is that it's an exchange that I'm going to learn from and be fed just as much as the audience is. In addition to film screenings, the festival's commitment to diversity and inclusion is a cornerstone of its programming. We have our community spotlight programming, which features films directed by African American, Native American, and LGBTQ filmmakers, Carney says, emphasizing the festival's role in amplifying diverse voices and stories. As the film festival continues to grow, Carney said that it not only boosts the local economy, affecting everything from hotels to restaurants, but also strengthens the fabric of the local film community. He says many local businesses report that the festival weekend is their busiest of the year. Carney also says Arizona's lower costs, compared to traditional film hubs like Los Angeles, coupled with new tax incentives, has made the state an increasingly attractive place for film production, and the festival has helped nurture the film community. It can be so brutal, and it's a life of mostly rejection, and yet, at the same time, we have to cling to those yeses, and you have to cling to your community, like look at who's around you, and who you could create with and stick together, Quadar says. Mesa Arts Center announces new Broadway series for next season. This following story was written by Jennifer Goldberg and posted on April 11th. Mesa is pretty far removed from the lights of Broadway, but beginning next season, the East Valley City will get a fresh taste of the Great White Way. For the first time since the 2010s, Mesa Arts Center will host a Broadway subscription series. Throughout recent years, our patrons have voiced their desire for the return of a Broadway series at the Mesa Arts Center, said Randall Vogel, Mesa Arts Center's Deputy Director of Theaters, in the announcement. We're thrilled to bring you some of the best new shows making their national tours. The shows with dates and descriptions are Come From Away, November 15th to 17th. On 9/11, the world stopped. On 9/12, their stories moved us all. This stirring and inspirational musical takes you into the heart of the remarkable true story of the small town in Newfoundland that opened their homes to 7,000 stranded travelers on 9/11. During that fateful week, cultures clashed and nerves ran high, but uneasiness turned into trust, music soared into the night, and gratitude grew into enduring friendships. Celebrate the best of humankind and the best in all of us at Come From Away. Dear Evan Hansen, February 28th to March 2nd. Dear Evan Hansen is the first contemporary musical about connection in the digital era. Meet Evan Hansen, a high school student who always feels like he's on the outside looking in. After writing a letter to himself that was never meant to be seen, Evan becomes entangled in a lie that was never meant to be told and a life he never dreamt would be his. As a result, Evan finally gets what so many of us are searching for, the chance to finally fit in. Packed with some of the most popular musical theater songs from the last decade, including You Will Be Found, Waving Through a Window, and For Forever. Dear Evan Hansen features an uplifting score by the Tony, Grammy, and Oscar-winning team behind The Greatest Showman, Benj Pasek and Justin Paul, and a book by Tony Award winner Stephen Levinson. The Cher Show, March 28th to 30th. Superstars come and go. Cher is forever. For six straight decades, only one unstoppable force has flat-out dominated popular culture, breaking down barriers, pushing boundaries, and letting nothing and no one stand in her way. The Cher Show is the Tony Award-winning musical of her story, and it's packed with so much Cher that it takes three women to play her. The kid, starting out, the glam pop star, and the icon. The Cher Show is 35 smash hits, six decades of stardom, two rock star husbands, a Grammy, an Oscar, an Emmy Award, and enough Bob Mackie gowns to cause a sequin shortage in New York City. All in one unabashedly fabulous new musical that will have audiences dancing in the aisles. Broadway subscription packages pricing starts at $117 and will be available to purchase beginning at noon on Friday. For more details, visit the website of the Mesa Arts Center. David Uola Jr. of Cronkite News wrote this next story that was posted on the Phoenix New Times website on April 10th. The first indigenous woman in space never planned on becoming an astronaut. Estrella Mountain Community College in Avondale celebrated Women's History Month by hosting an event on March 27th. Marine Colonel Nicole Mann, a member of the Wailaki tribe of the Round Valley Indian Tribes, was invited to speak at the event. She shared her unorthodox journey to becoming an astronaut. Mann is the first female indigenous astronaut and only the second indigenous person to go into space. Early on, as a child, Mann said that she knew she wanted to serve in the military, but wasn't sure which path to take. The idea of being an astronaut hadn't even entered my mind at this point. I had never met an astronaut before. I didn't exactly know what they did. It seemed like something that other people did from somewhere else, right? But it's not something for me, Mann said at the community college event. At the U.S. Naval Academy, she knew early on that she wanted to be a Marine. According to her NASA profile, Mann earned her bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering from the Naval Academy in 1999 and was commissioned as a Marine second lieutenant that same year. In 2001, Mann earned a master's degree in mechanical engineering with a specialization in fluid mechanics from Stanford University. 3 years later, she began her flying career with the Thunderbolts of VMFA 251, a Marine fighter jet squadron. During this time, she flew combat missions in Iraq and Afghanistan. Again, I came to a crossroads. What am I going to do next? Mann said. She was looking at her next set of orders and she was doing an online search for words like fighter pilots and engineering, when she came across results such as test pilot school and astronauts. She then noticed bios of some current astronauts who were Marines, fighter pilots, and had engineering degrees. And that is the first time it really dawned on me. Wow, I wonder if this is something that I can do, Mann said. Self-doubt. After researching the career in 2009, Mann said she began 3 years as a test pilot on the FA-18, where she would push the jet and its weapons at or past their designed limits. During this time, Mann said she got married and pregnant with her son. It was while she was pregnant that Mann saw that NASA was accepting applicants for the next astronaut class. I have to be honest with you. At that time, I thought, well, I mean, that would have been great years ago, maybe, right? It was fun being a fighter pilot. It was fun being a test pilot. But now, I'm going to be a mom. It's time for me to move on. Things need to change, Mann said. She remembers coming home and telling her husband about NASA selecting applicants, but she wasn't going to apply. She said her husband looked at her like she was crazy, and he asked her why she shouldn't apply, and she responded, because we're pregnant. He goes, oh my God, you can never give up on this dream. If you don't apply, then you're never going to make it. You're going to discount yourself, and you're never going to know, Mann said. A mom and a professional. My husband was right. You can be a mom and a professional and have a family at the same time, Mann said. Her testimony of being a mother and a professional resonated with Raquel Nezzi, a single mother, an Estrella Mountain Community College student, and the vice president of the American Indian Science and Engineering Society chapter at the college. Nezzi called it, quote, very inspirational and motivational. Sharon Steffen, a math faculty member at EMCC and director of the school's STEM Center of Excellence, said it was really important for students to hear Mann say that she was not sure how her life path was going to turn out. Steffen said students who come to the community college do not necessarily have their full life planned out, but they do have dreams and desires and ambitions, just like her. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook.